Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Joining me today is one of our producers, Gary LeMaster.
Good morning, everyone.
And we'll be talking to Dr. Michael Austin, who's written a really interesting book called That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America's Right Wing. Michael, are you there?
Right here.
Well,
thank
good.
You very
and,
much.
And you're a professor and vice president of academic affairs at Newman University.
Newman University in Wichita, Kansas.
Wichita, Kansas, near my old hometown of Claremore, Oklahoma.
I used to go not to far Wichita. Away at all.
Not far away at all.
Hmm.
Michael Austin has written a whole bunch of books. And just to give you an idea, one of them is called New Testaments, Cognition, Closure, and Figural Logic of the Sequel, 1660 to 1740. So he writes a lot of stuff that we're not going to be talking about today. Right, Gary?
A lot of academic books that are a little above my level. So
I keep expecting that Milton and Bunyan are going to make a big comeback, and you know, and that book will be right there on the cusp.
We're getting, particularly from Tea Party folks, an impression that the Founding Fathers was kind of a group of like-minded individuals who agreed about all the basics of the American Constitution and what kind of country we should have. What were the Founding Fathers actually like?
They agreed on one thing. The people we call Founding Fathers, and you know, and it's a little bit controversial how you just define that term, because there isn't a list that everybody agrees on, but generally the people we call Founding Fathers agreed that America should not be governed by the British. And that's about all that they agreed on. They disagreed violently on most of the important issues of their day. Only about half of them supported the Constitution. A lot of the people that we revere as Founding Fathers, like Patrick Henry or John Hancock, Samuel Adams, opposed the Constitution, fought hard against it. They disagreed on whether or not the states should be more powerful than the federal government. They disagreed on the role of religion in the public square. They disagreed on whether or not we should balance our budget with austerity or with increased taxes. They had all of the same fights that we're having, and they actually had them in a much more violent way. Look at, say, Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr shooting at each other in Weehawken, New Jersey. So the idea that seems to have come down, and it's been more than 100 years that we've talked about the Founding Fathers as if they were a ideologically coherent body of human beings who thought about the same way that we think about contemporary issues. That's the way that mythology works. That's not the way that history works.
You trace the term Founding Fathers, I think, to Warren G. Harding, who was not exactly one of our, you know, best presidents, shall we say. I mean, he's on the short list of worst presidents of the United States history. But he's the one who started talking about Founding Fathers.
In 1916, Harding used the term Founding Fathers in a political speech in the National Convention. He was the chair of the Republican National Convention at that time. Previously, we'd heard Founders and we'd heard Fathers. So they were kind of dancing around it for a while. But Founding Fathers becomes a word in 1916.
So the one point of your book is, and then I'll pass you over to Gary, one point of your book is that there wasn't a Founding Fathers view of almost anything except separation from Britain.
That was about it.
There were even disagreements about whether to have a monarchy or a democracy or a republic, right?
Yes, there were monarchists, there were anarchists, there were slave owners, there were abolitionists, there were Christians, there were atheists. There was just a wide, wide spectrum of belief, probably wider than the spectrum of belief in our current political system.
And the Constitution, it had 55 delegates, and only 39 of them signed on to the Constitution. And some of the people being widely quoted didn't like the Constitution at all. Patrick Henry, for example. And
even Thomas Jefferson, who was in France at the time, but he was only tepidly supportive of the Constitution and had some real problems with it.
Both Jefferson and Adams weren't there, right? They were both in diplomatic posts, and so they had a great deal of trouble making a connection with what was happening. And
this is a very important point because when I speak on this, I show a poster of Jefferson and Washington and Benjamin Franklin and the Constitution and Independence Hall, and we have to realize that no, Jefferson wasn't there. Jefferson was in France. Adams was in England, and the things that they said about it, they're getting just a few reports by letter many weeks after things have happened. And so what they say about the Constitution is based on relatively low information at the time.
I thought it was fascinating that Jefferson viewed the Constitution, like you said, it appears that he was against it, or parts of it at least, but he viewed it as as the beginning, that it wasn't something carved in stone, it was something that he hoped would change over time.
Jefferson believed that no constitution could last longer than one generation, or it would become a dictatorship. So he believed that you should change your constitution every 19 years. Now, he didn't believe that when he became president.
Right.
Jefferson believed a lot of things before he was president that when he was president, he didn't believe so much anymore.
Now, that never happens nowadays, right?
One of the other things I found fascinating, I don't know if it was in your book or if I read it, and I've been reading a lot of Founding Fathers books lately, one of the things I found fascinating, there was a contingent of the so-called Founding Fathers that wanted to create another monarchy in the United States, that they wanted to take a son a young man who was a son of one of the European kings and make him our monarch.
Yeah, Hamilton actually flirted with this. It was a Prussian king that they had thought of inviting to come and become the king of America. So this was an extreme minority position. Most of the people we call founding fathers were not monarchists, but there were a few who, because really nobody had ever tried to govern a country as large as the United States without a king before. So they were in very, very uncharted territory. So in the early, as they were batting things around, there were a few of them that did talk about inviting a European monarch to come and take the throne. But that one probably wouldn't have gone anywhere, no matter who brought it up, because it was not the general consensus at the time.
So the founding fathers, to go back to the point, are not a unified group with a particular vision of the country, but a bunch of people, individuals, just like we have today, who cared very much about the country, very much about what's going to happen, but had a lot of different views about what should happen on almost all the basic issues.
Then, absolutely.
Then how was the Constitution created? It was about 4,500 words, and 200 years there, it's now about 7,000 words. How was it created? I want to keep slavery. Somebody else wants to abolish it. I believe that the small states should have more representation. Another person believes that it should be totally based on proportionality. How did these issues get resolved? What is the Constitution in at core, in your view?
I think the Constitution at its core is a verb, not a noun. It is the thing that constitutes us as a nation. And that means it's the set of ground rules that we have our discussions on. It doesn't tell us the answers. It gives us a way to structure the questions. And I think that when the Constitution was created in 1787, the most important thing that the framers did was they created an environment where you had to compromise if you were going to move forward at all. And they created an environment. And largely, it was created for them by the structure of the Articles of Confederation at the time. But the rules that they set in motion in the Federal Convention made it easy for almost anybody to shut the discussion down. So there was a very powerful motivation for compromise in the creation of the Constitution itself, if they wanted to go forward. And most of the people there believed that the Articles of Confederation were simply too weak to allow a government to form and move forward. So there was a general, not a unanimous, but a general belief that the federal government had to be stronger. And they didn't quite agree on the ways that it had to be stronger, but they agreed that the status quo was inadequate. And that's kind of the definition of a crisis. A crisis is when the status quo just won't work anymore. And so then they had all of these issues, and there were dozens of very difficult issues where they disagreed, but they had a powerful motivation for compromise. And the document that they created, the Constitution, I usually call an engine of compromise, because the Constitution, it sets up the procedures, it sets up the ground rules for political debate, and it makes it easy to stop anything from happening. It's much easier under the Constitution to stop anything from happening than it is to make anything happen. You know, the president can veto, five Supreme Court justices can overturn something, small members of the minority in Congress can prevent anything from going forward. So it was set up to make us compromise with each other rather than to try to rely on our coming to a consensus, which I think most of the founders recognized that human nature is never going to agree on everything. We're not going to produce widespread agreement. What we can produce are workable compromises that allow us to move forward.
So even of the 39 people who signed the Constitution, probably none of them agreed with every single article or the phrasing. It was fundamentally a compromise between different interests, different people.
Absolutely. Benjamin Franklin, on one of the final days of the convention, stood up in the convention and said that he certainly did not agree with everything in this convention, but he was going to sacrifice his disagreements to the public good.
The other thing that you mentioned I thought was interesting, and I don't know whether Gary knew it, but I didn't, which was that after the Constitutional Convention, they didn't publish any of their discussions about the Constitution. They didn't publish any of the dialogue and debate about the Constitution that occurred in the convention. They kept that secret. They just produced the Constitution itself. Why did they do that?
Madison took the best notes of the convention. He took very, very complete notes of the convention that we have today. They were not published during his lifetime, because Madison believed that what they said in the convention should not govern people's interpretation of the Constitution. People had to take the document as it was written, and he didn't think, and he said a number of times when he was in the House of Representatives, as people were debating the Constitution, you know, people would look at him and say, well, you guys wrote this, what did you mean? And he would say, it doesn't matter what we were thinking, it matters what we wrote. So yes, Madison by himself embargoed those notes until after his death.
You have a whole discussion of what you call proof texting, and that we see a tremendous amount of, a series of quotes by either guys on the left or the right that prove their point. And what is proof texting, and how does that differ from a scholar going in and trying to see what was actually going on?
Proof texting, and that's a term that comes from biblical criticism. It's how a lot of people read the Bible. But proof texting is the process of coming up with a quotation that supports the agenda that you want it to support, whether or not the context justifies that. And you can usually tell somebody is proof texting with the Constitution if they quote Thomas Jefferson or John Adams in support of what the Constitution really means, because Thomas Jefferson and John Adams weren't there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's usually the first clue that I have that somebody is being insensitive to context, is they start interpreting the Constitution with the quotations of people who aren't there. But it also means that the people who designed the Constitution, who framed the Constitution, this is 55 different people, all of whom lived a long time and wrote an enormous amount. And we have, and there are just thousands of volumes of the letters and the writings and the speeches and the books of the people that we call founding fathers. And going through those, you can support just about any proposition. You can prove that they were liberals, that they were conservatives, or that they were atheists, or that they were evangelical Christians, or that they were chocolate chip cookies or baked potatoes, if you try hard enough.
You have a term in the book that I loved, which is called Founderstein. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Founderstein, and that's the concept I tried to use to bring everything together. Founderstein is like the Frankenstein monster. It's the Founderstein monster. It is the founding fathers as a collective hive mind, where you just combine quotations from the works of half a dozen different people and assert this as what the founding fathers meant, with no sensitivity to original context, no understanding of the debates that these were situated in. And rather than say, well, Thomas Jefferson at this point in his career believed this, when he was talking about this, this is what he said. No, that's the sort of thing that historians and scholars do. You pick out proof texts here and there. Well, Jefferson said this, Thomas Adams said this, and thus we see that the founders loved guns, or that they were all a bunch of atheist deists. And you can prove almost anything that way. You can create a Founderstein monster that proves almost any point you want to make, as long as you're willing to assume that the founders thought completely alike, and that any quote from any founder about anything is a legitimate interpretive tool for the Constitution.
We do recommend you read Michael Austin's book. He has some devastating portraits of ways that Foundersteins are constructed, and they really are like Frankenstein. They're constructed of different parts thrown together to create a particular political monster, right?
And it's both the right and the left does this. I think in the current historical moment, these kinds of historical arguments are more common on the right wing, especially with the Tea Party kind of far right. And that was the main thing that I wrote the book about, was the way that some of the figures on the far right, the Glenn Becks or the Mark Levin or Rick Perry, for example, the way that they incorporate very bad historical arguments into justifying their current positions.
Well, the thing that mystifies me is that they've even taken quotes that they attribute to founders that the founders never even said. There's a couple of very popular ones with the Tea Party. One is when the people find out that they can vote themselves money that will herald the end of the republic. I've seen that over and over again in Tea Party materials, and yet whenever I look it up and try to find some evidence that Franklin never said it, it always is labeled as misattributed to someone else. Is that true?
That is one that is true. There's another one that's been going around. Jefferson saying that when the people are afraid of their government, that's tyranny. When the government is afraid of the people, that's liberty, which is nonsense. Jefferson never said any such thing. But somebody hears this quote, and, you know, the Internet is really great at spreading these kinds of quotes around. You put this with a picture of Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, and you pass it around, and everybody sees it. And people gravitate to things that confirm what they already believe. I mean, this is one thing you have to realize about human cognition is that our brains were not designed to find the truth. Our brains were designed to justify whatever we happen to believe.
So we have to work to find the truth, right? I see it mostly happening on the right. I don't see the left doing it, but I've seen the Treaty of Tripoli, for example, quoted to assert that the United States isn't a Christian nation, and we say in writing in the treaty just that. Mm-hmm. That's just one quote of many quotes, right?
Right, and that, you know, the Treaty of Tripoli, that's the language of diplomacy, and it's not always accurate to use the language of diplomacy when you're trying to soothe somebody's ego to represent what everybody thought at the time. You know, and the Treaty of Tripoli is not a particularly good place to look for anybody's definition of what the United States is.
We hear all the time the term original intent, and we hear it not only from the parties themselves and this kind of raucous political discussion we have these days, but we hear it from the even as high as the Supreme Court justices are trying to divine what the founders really intended with the Constitution. You have a chapter kind of devoted to that in the book. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, there are two concepts we have to separate that aren't often separated in public discourse. One is original intent, and the other is something like original public meaning. The original public meaning, I think, is a very legitimate interpretive technique, and that is you try to find out what the words on the page meant in their original context, how somebody reading this document in 1787 would have understood some terms. And I think that is a legitimate way to look at the Constitution. The other is to try to figure out what people were thinking when they wrote it by looking at what they said in other contexts. You know, look at what Madison said maybe 10 years earlier in a letter, or what Hamilton wrote 15 years later in a report to Congress. Try to engage in a kind of historical telepathy, a long-distance mind reading, to try to figure out what people were really thinking. And that, not only is it impossible, but it misrepresents almost everything about the Constitutional Convention when you try to do that. First of all, because nobody's original intent prevailed in the Constitution. It was a compromise document. So a lot of people intended things that didn't end up in the original document, but also because Justice Scalia, who agrees with the idea of looking at the Constitution for the original public understanding, but absolutely disagrees with looking for the original intent, he says it's unfair. It's fundamentally undemocratic to try to govern by what a lawmaker intended instead of what a lawmaker actually wrote.
So there's public things and public announcement, public policy, and there's private musings about it too. Not only do people have different intentions who signed onto the Constitution, but it's as you point out in your book, it's not written by a single individual. It's not written by John Milton or somebody to be interpreted in the same way that you would an author's work.
For example, it's legitimate if you're trying to understand the Second Amendment. It's legitimate to try to understand what people meant by militia in 1790. That's a very different thing, trying to understand what the word militia meant in 1790, than trying to figure out what was in James Madison's head when he wrote that.
Let's take that issue for a couple of minutes. That's one of the most baffling things. It's about the right to bear arms, and it's kind of on the surface a kind of baffling statement. And I don't have it in front of me, but it's a militia being necessary. The right to people to
well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free people, or free
the right to bear arms shall not be infringed.
Bear arms shall be infringed. Right
now, what was a militia then? Because we don't really have we have sort of joke militias, like Joe Arpaio has a militia of guys, some of whom who have jail records. But what was a militia then, and why was it why is that in that particular statement?
And this is a fascinating story. I did not put this in the book, but I have since written a chapter that I've put online called That's Not What They Meant About Guns, which deals with the history of what a militia was, what well-regulated meant. But at the time the Constitution was written, there was no standing army, and a lot of people believed that standing armies were inimical to liberty, that standing armies would become instruments of tyranny in the hands of a despot. So most of the state constitutions at the time prevented standing armies and required people to participate in the local militia. And citizens were expected to be members of the local militia. And the British had tried to disarm the local militia several times during the revolution and replace local militias with standing armies. So the protection of the militia in the Second Amendment comes from a desire not to have a standing army.
But we have the huge standing army and have had a standing army now for, what, 180 years or something?
That one didn't work out so well, that no standing army thing.
There's even the Third Amendment even addresses this issue of it not being legal to have to house a soldier in your home during times of peace unless it was consensual. So.
And that the Second and Third Amendments really do go together. You're not allowed to disarm the militia, bring in a standing army, and quarter the soldiers in somebody's home. I mean, that's all part of one prohibition.
In some of the time we've got left, maybe you could address the founders' thoughts on religious freedom. That's another big one that seems to always come up in controversy.
Well, they did not have a consistent view of religious freedom. They fought about this quite a bit. Patrick Henry, in 1785, before the Constitution was written, Patrick Henry wanted, he was governor of Virginia, he wanted a tax that would support all religions equally. He said, we're not going to choose a religion, but we do want to tax people for the support of religion. James Madison wrote a wonderful little pamphlet called The Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessment that goes down and makes the argument that Jefferson had made a little bit earlier, before he left for France, that religion was something that was entirely separate from the social contract. One entered into religious observance separate from one's obligations to a state, and therefore the state could simply have nothing to say for or against any particular religion. What Jefferson and Madison believed is that religious ideas participated in a free market of ideas where the government never put its finger on the scale, that all religious ideas were protected as ideas, and that the government never supported with either government attention or government funds any religious belief. That was the position of Jefferson and of Madison. It was not the position of Washington or Adams. Washington and Adams believed that it was appropriate for the government to kind of do things like proclaim days of fasting and Thanksgiving and religious observances. Neither of them wanted a state religion, of course.
Well,
but
we've got just 1 minute left. That's okay. A really interesting discussion. We should talk to you again about some of these issues because there's so much of it. Michael Austin's book is called That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America Right Wing. And it's available on Amazon. It's available on Kindle. It was published fairly recently. Last year, was it?
Last September. It was published on Constitution Day.
Well, that's an appropriate time to publish it. We have a couple of announcements. The movie next week, the Door movie at the Sedona Public Library, is on the issue, a very unpleasant issue of rape in the military. The film was nominated for an Academy Award. It didn't get it, but it was a significant film. That's March 13th at the Public Library. I think it's 6 a.m.
6 p.m.
6 p.m. And then next March 21st, we have Harriet Young, a professor up at NAU, and she's going to speak on ALEC. The Arizona legislature did not become crazy on its own. And that should be an interesting thing. And then next week, Bill Timmerman will be coming in, one of our producers, and talking about fracking and the future of renewable energy. It's one of Bill's in-depth reports. Gary, we want to say goodbye and thank.
Just want to thank you, Michael. It's been great.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.